ideas don't just come full blown from your head. You know, you grind them out, you discover them. I think it's why I've been a professional writer since 1982, and my first drafts still suck. And the reason I don't get upset is because it's not an act of creation, it's an act of discovery.
It's How to Be Amazing. I'm Michael Ian Black. You know, there's not much that I feel qualified in saying with any amount of authority, but I do feel qualified in saying this. Making television is a tough business. I also feel qualified in saying that making television comedy, while often fun and funny, is not always, or even perhaps mostly, fun and funny. And nobody knows this better than my guest today, who has spent most of her career slogging away in the TV trenches. Nell Scovell has worked on many of the best and some of the not so best shows of the last three decades. I'll give you a partial list: The Simpsons, Late Night with David Letterman, Newhart, Charmed, Murphy Brown, Monk. She created and ran the hit Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and she was often the only woman in the writer's room. Her new memoir, Just the Funny Parts, recounts her ongoing TV career and the gender inequality she faced, and I am delighted to welcome the very funny Nell Scovell to How to Be Amazing. Nell, I'm just going to jump right into it. What makes something the right joke?
Someone once asked me how I could have written for Providence, which was this very sincere medical show, and The Simpsons, which is, you know, this dark, snarky show. And it's not about writing for the show. It's about writing for the audience.
When you say you're writing for the audience, one thing that I always try to be careful of as a comedian, and maybe I suppose this would be different if I'm, well, I don't know. I think there's sometimes an internal conflict between writing towards the jokes that you think are funny versus writing for the jokes that you think the audience will think is funny. And by doing the latter, I think there's sometimes a danger of hurting your own work or not trusting your own voice. And how do you, Nell, reconcile those conflicting desires?
Right. Well, I do believe that when writing comedy, if you've never been told you've gone too far, then you probably haven't gone far enough. And if you're constantly being told you've gone too far, then you're an asshole. So I do try, you know, you want to push that line. And I had the pleasure of writing for President Obama's White House Correspondents' Dinner for many years. And that was one where, you know, you kind of got a sense of what kind of jokes the president would be willing to tell, but you couldn't help but slip in one or two that you knew.
I have to read one of my favorite unused joke of yours.
So I include a bunch of these unused jokes. Oh, thanks.
I just thought, this is hilarious. All right. So this is a joke that I guess you pitched to Obama, or at least his people. Yeah. And I can't believe for a second you ever thought he would say this. And here's the joke. I turned 50 while in office, which meant I had to have my first colonoscopy. And guess what they found? Mitch McConnell. That guy can obstruct anything. I thought, there's no way, when you wrote that, you thought the president of the United States would say those words. Or did you?
Well, and I thought, how could he not? I really did. I was shocked.
Because I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because you're saying, first you've got the president of the United States talking about his own butt.
Oh, right. Yeah, I did that.
and then you've placed the Senate Majority Leader inside his own asshole.
Well, when you put it that way.
I would say it, but I suppose the president of the United States, at least traditionally, has had to have a little decorum. And yes. Honestly, I think I prefer that.
He was so funny. Boy, he, you know, he had Johnny Carson's timing.
Just this week, Michelle Bachmann actually predicted that I would bring about the biblical end of days. Now that's a legacy. That's big. I mean, Lincoln, Washington, they didn't do that.
Yeah, I think that's a great comparison because he's dry. He's really dry, and he has really good timing.
And I wrote another joke for him, which he did do at the Al Smith dinner, and he appeared there with Mitt Romney. It was during that campaign. And the joke was, Mitt and I have a lot in common. We both went to Harvard. We both have wonderful wives. We both have unusual names. Actually, Mitt is his middle name. I wish I could use my middle name. And he said it with this hint of sadness. But see, that was about knowing the audience, because you have to know that everybody knows that his middle name is Hussein. Mm-hmm. That's a cultural joke.
Wait, Mitt Romney's middle name is Hussein?
Yes.
Was that a good joke? I'm just going to look to you. Was that a good joke?
No, that is
a Wait, there was something, because you're talking about the Al Smith dinner, and then you were talking about, because you also wrote for Hillary.
Yes.
And you talk about that memorable Al Smith dinner where Trump and Hillary were both attending, and you talk about Trump's sense of humor, I use that term advisedly, versus Hillary's, and the way that Trump opened his remarks, which was so deeply ugly.
For example, here she is tonight in public pretending not to hate Catholics. Now, if some of you haven't noticed, Hillary isn't laughing as much as the rest of us. That's because she knows the jokes. And all of the jokes were given to her in advance of the dinner by Donna Brazile.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that?
And by the way, at the same time, there was this fake news article hitting all social media that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm convinced that was part of the reason she lost.
Was that article?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're...
I mean, the numbers are true. A lot more Catholics voted for Obama than they did for Hillary.
Right.
Yeah.
I think you make a really interesting point about that particular joke as being emblematic of Donald Trump's sense of humor, which is, you say, it's not funny because it's cruel. And, well, first of all, it's just nonsense. But on top of that, it's cruel. And I think you make, the really smart point that good comedy requires empathy.
Right. Or a common sense of we all feel this way.
Right.
An understanding. I think, you know what the right always gets wrong? You know, they've tried to do their comedy shows like, you know, The Daily Show. And they try to make them snarky, but from their point of view, I think if someone did a show that was just mean, that just, you know, called people ugly and stupid, it could do very well.
Wait, what do you mean? Why do you say that? I'm actually kind of thinking of shows that actually do that and have done well. But where does that instinct come from?
Oh, from Trump and like that time he posted the video of him hitting a golf ball and spliced it together with Hillary falling down.
Right. There's something. It's lower than lowbrow. It's primal in a way.
Yes.
It's this idea of The Simpsons. Who's that character that just goes?
Right, Ralph,
that's all that is.
Yes.
And America's Funniest Home Videos is essentially that. Is the world going, ah-ha. But there's a little bit of kind-heartedness to it and a little bit of what we all know that they're going to be okay. But when the President of the United States does it, it's not funny. In fact, now that I say that, and I'm sorry because I didn't mean for this to get political, but I remember the one moment that I specifically remember really cringing from Obama. Was when he made the joke, somebody asked him something about like, I don't know, whatever it was, UFOs or something. And he goes, I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you. Mm. And I was like, you can't make that joke.
That's right.
Because you have that.
You're a commander in chief of the U.S. Armed Forces.
Did you always feel like growing up that you understood intuitively the empathy and the we're all in this together kindness or level of comedy? Or was it was your comedy when you were younger Well, I guess just what was your comedy like when you were a kid and when you were starting out?
No, and I tell a story about working at the Smothers Brothers, and this is in 89, and I made a crass joke.
I should just make the point. This is they rebooted the Smothers Brothers.
Right.
It did not run continuously from 66 or 68. Yeah. It's
the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour with guest stars, the committee, the all. Jennifer Warren.
So I don't know if people remember Mama Cass from The Mamas and the Papas, and very sad story. Cass Elliot died very young, and there was this rumor that she died because she choked on a sandwich. She was heavy. And I made a joke in front of Tommy Smothers about it, like, it's too bad she didn't have the soup. And he wheeled on me and said, I loved Cass Elliot. She was a wonderful human being. And it really hit me hard. I mean, I have never forgotten that moment. I felt so small and petty. But again, it goes back to knowing your audience, because that was not a good joke to make in front of someone who knew this person.
Right. I find that joke funny.
Well, yes. See? No, but I thought it was such a good lesson. Or I edit myself more from telling mean jokes. Mm-hmm. And I often weigh, is this funny enough to offset the cruelty?
Right. I often think when making those jokes, would the person I'm making this joke about find it funny? Like in the case of a dead celebrity.
Right.
And generally, I don't know the person,
yeah,
but I sort of have a sense of them. And if I feel like, yeah, maybe they would get a laugh out of that, then I'll make the joke.
So, but you never joke about Frank Sinatra.
No, oh, God, no.
He would not find that funny.
No. In fact, we're just going to edit out the name Frank Sinatra, just in case.
Just in case. He's listening.
You talk a lot about your family being funny growing up, and in particular, your mom and your aunts, and how that early support group of women, largely, even though you say your dad is funny too, gave you the confidence to think of yourself as funny. When was the first moment that you became aware that not everybody thought women were funny by virtue of their gender?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think it was sort of a slow realization, and I don't know there was one moment. I was shocked when that Christopher Hitchens article came out in Vanity Fair not that long ago, because that just seemed like an issue that had been put to bed a long time ago. But, you know, I grew up where Carol Burnett had her variety show. Joan Rivers guest hosted The Tonight Show constantly. If you were born after 1970, you never saw a female doing that on one of the big networks.
Right.
And that was hugely influential. And I thought she was funnier than Johnny. So it was a real surprise. I mean, maybe in college I started to feel like that idea of women aren't as funny and, you know, men tell dirty jokes to each other, but they don't include women.
So you got through high school with this confidence intact, which I think is an even middle school, which is a really difficult time for
girls.
Well,
can I tell the
Please.
Story about my mom?
Yeah.
So my mom goes to my third grade parent-teacher conference, and the teacher tells her, Nell makes too many jokes in class. Could you please ask her to tone it down? So my mother delivers this message to me on my 40th birthday. It was so great that she protected me.
Oh, that's a remarkable piece of parenting.
Yeah.
Because, I'll just state the obvious, what it says is she understood not only your gifts, but their value.
Yeah.
Which I think is just the loveliest gift you can give to your kid. Nell Scovell may not be a household name, but chances are you have laughed at one or perhaps many, many, many of her jokes for over 30 years. She has worked behind the scenes on over a dozen hit television shows. Only the second woman ever to write for David Letterman, she didn't stay silent when the sex scandal broke in 2009, writing a scathing essay in Vanity Fair calling out the lack of gender diversity in the late-night writer's room. Coming up, she recounts her time working for Letterman, how she, quote, focuses on the process to stay grounded, and why she walked away from her dream job. You went to Harvard, and you write in the book that you didn't have the confidence to submit, I guess, to the right. Lampoon, which is the big humor magazine, and in a lot of ways, the foundation of American humor writing, although I think that's changing. But so clearly that idea had permeated your consciousness before you got there, that you weren't good enough in some capacity.
Right. But I think there was a distinction between, like, you know, I crack wise and I'm professionally funny. Mm. And that was the difference there. And, you know, it was a long time later when I joined Spy magazine, and again, that's very snarky, and I can do that, and then I go write for Vanity Fair, and I do more snarky stuff, and then one day, I run into an editor friend on the street, and she says to me, I don't mean this as an insult, but I think you could write for television. And that was the first time it ever occurred to me. So I sat down and wrote a spec script for It's Gary Shandling's Show, and they bought it.
The theme, the Gary Show. The theme, the Gary Show. Gary called me up and asked if I would write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme, the Gary Show?
I know, which is crazy to me. Yeah. Like, your first script. And for him.
Yeah. And then they never made it.
But still. That door just kind of swung open for you, or at least cracked open.
Yeah.
And you walked through.
I mean, I was thinking about this, and there, you know, if you like disappointment, have I got a career for you. Become a TV writer. Mm-hmm. I did get just enough positive reinforcement to keep me going.
Right.
You know, through those low times.
That's one of the things that this is one of the reasons I actually really wanted to talk to you today, is because a lot of guests that we have here are super successful and have kind of been successful their whole lives. Like, they were brilliant and they stayed brilliant. And you're brilliant, but a lot of your career is marked by ups and downs and ups and downs. And what I really respond to about your career is the hustle. Because I think so many people can relate to it, myself included. This idea of, this is going to work, and then five things are going to fail, and then something, and then I'll stumble into something. How do you stay motivated through all those ups and downs?
I did have a very stable family, and I think that helps a ton. And we were talking about this earlier. I think you have to focus on the process. You know, I think about it like Sisyphus, where you roll the rock up the hill.
But Sisyphus is miserable.
No, he's not. You have to read Camus' essay, and he imagines Sisyphus.
No, we both know I'm not going to read Camus' essay. We both know that.
Really? It's short.
All right, maybe I'll read it.
It's got this great line, there is no fate that cannot be surmounted by scorn.
I don't understand that.
Well, he's pushing up the rock and thinking, fuck you. I know you're going to push it down. I can't control that, but I'm doing my job.
Right. Oh, right? So the scorn is coming from him.
He's proletariat.
Right. He's saying, fuck you.
Yeah.
I'm not giving up.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, that's lovely.
It is.
I'm reading, I'm currently reading the Thomas Hardy book, Jude the Obscure. And
really?
Yeah. For reasons that I won't get into, but I'll just plug it here. I have a new podcast about reading Jude the Obscure out loud and commenting on it as I go. But in reading Jude the Obscure, it's the same thing. It's that thing of fate is just going to throw shit in your path. And sometimes you're just like, I'm going to step in this shit and keep going. And I think that's, I think that's so valuable for any creative person to hear.
Well, I say my motto in the book is, That which doesn't kill me allows me to regroup and retaliate.
But one of the interesting things about this is you said when you sat down to write this book, like part of you did just want to retaliate. That you did want this to be score settling in a certain way. And then you found it wasn't satisfying.
No, you start writing and you think, I wrote some movies and TV shows with Joel Hodgson from Mystery Science Theater 3000. And I started writing about him. And I thought, well, that's going to be the first 2.5 pages to this other chapter about collaboration. And then I just kept writing about him because it was filling me with joy. And I love our friendship so much. And it's so much nicer to praise people who you love and who supported you. And I even made a T-shirt that I haven't had the guts to wear, but it says, "I'm writing a memoir and you're not in it."
That's really very good.
So
it also could have been a good alternate title.
Yeah, they had, at the last second, they had a question about this title. And they said, it doesn't bring up the gender, which bothered me because there, gender factors in, but, I write many chapters where it isn't an issue, right, in the Simpsons chapter. And I said I came up with another title I like, and it was Penis, 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 Me, Penis. And then suddenly they loved just the funny parts.
I actually thought in examining the title as I do, that there was a slight double entendre there, that there was a thing about the idea of parts as being masculine and or feminine, and that distinction is funny, and that distinction, it does play a part in this book. That should have been the response to your editors, and I will now go back in time with you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's how I took it. And then
like lady parts, just the funny parts. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there were, I
think
to me,
subconsciously.
And then a few hard truths about sneaking into the Hollywood Boys Club. I mean, come on. Those are double entendres.
Well, yeah.
You're saying not intentionally.
Yeah. No, and it's the other great thing about having that title, and it came early on actually from one of my mentors, this guy, Barry Kemp, who created Coach and Newhart, who pitched it to me. And I actually know a good pitch when I hear it. It helped guide me because sometimes I would start sliding into the darker places and then I would kind of recall like, no, just the funny parts.
There was something really interesting you said about Barry Kemp. I was watching this interview you did with John Oliver and you said, and I'm going to find it. It's going to take a second for me.
He wrote some of my favorite episodes of Taxi. Oh. He wrote that great one where Jim, the who makes the prediction that death will come to Louis's door dressed in a Girl Scout uniform or wearing a hockey mask or I don't know. It was so funny.
All right. Here's the thing about Barry Kemp, which I thought was really wise. So Barry created Newhart, created Coach, and was one of your mentors. And he said to you, or this is the lesson you took from him, writing isn't an act of creation. It's an act of discovery. And I thought that was a really wise thing to say. And I wondered if you could explain to the audience how you interpreted that.
Ideas don't just come full blown from your head. You grind them out, you discover them. I think it's why I've been a professional writer since 1982, and my first drafts still suck. And the reason I don't get upset is because it's not an act of creation, it's an act of discovery.
Right.
So this is just a starting point on the path, and you just keep walking down that path, and when you hit a dead end, you go back to where you last thought you were on the right path and try to find another route.
I'm going to paint with a broad gender brush here for a second, but I suspect it may be true to a certain extent. I think men, as writers, have a harder time learning that lesson than women, because I think their ego gets wrapped up in their own creation and saying, I created this. And maybe I'm just talking about myself here, and therefore it's good. And it's harder to say, I created this, and I know it's just a starting place, where I feel like, I don't know, maybe I'm just wrong about this, but I feel like women have an easier time landing on that, what I think is a first lesson of writing. I guess I'm just looking for confirmation here. Has that been true in your experience that women have an easier time kind of letting things evolve and grow in an organic way as opposed to the man who is fighting for this joke or who's unwilling to kill his darlings?
I think men can lock in. I mean, maybe more than women only because there are more men writing than for TV than women. But I'm pretty good at not locking in and realizing, oh, there's a better way to do this. Or, you know, I've written myself into a corner and can't get to this ending I want. And then there's a story. So I worked for a year on NCIS.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm in your head.
Well, you kind of are, because as soon as he said locked in, I was like, wait a minute now. I'm going to call bullshit on you.
Well, so I was assigned a script, and it was kind of a take on DOA. That, do you remember that movie where the guy walks in and says, I want to report a murder? Me?
I want to report a murder. Sit down. Where was this murder committed?
San Francisco, last night.
Who was murdered?
I was.
So the guy running NCIS was this TV legend, Don Bellisario, who created Magnum PI and Quantum Leap. And he was this big, gruff man who chomped on cigars. And I once made the mistake of calling him a former Marine. Marines are forever. No one is ever a former
Of course.
Marine. You knew that?
No. I'm okay. Nodding like I knew it because it makes sense to me. But no, yeah. I didn't know that.
So I write this script and he reads it and I get called into his office, which was always frightening. And he told me he loved teaser one and acts 1 through 3, but he wanted a new killer in act 4. And I said, so I need to rewrite the whole script. And he said, no, just give me a new killer. And I said, well, all the clues will point to that other guy. And he said, I don't care. So I went back and I just had to like rethink. And it's hard because that was a case where my brain had locked in.
Right. You had to backwards engineer it.
Yes. So I come up with this new killer. I write a new fourth act. We shoot it. People love the episode. And why? I couldn't guess who the killer was. I had no idea. I didn't see it coming.
That's not what I was going to ask you about. So
that was kind of brilliant.
Oh, brilliant.
And it was such a good lesson because, you know, most writers, you think everything should tie up in a bow and the thing you set in motion in act one should pay off in act four. I'm not sure that's how people watch TV.
Right.
I think they're just in it for the ride. And as long as you take them someplace satisfying, they're not sitting there going, but wait.
Right.
In act one, the character said.
But there's that question of inevitability where it's most satisfying when the outcome feels both surprising and inevitable.
Yes.
And so when you look back on that story in particular, did you achieve those goals or was it just like, oh, this is just an entertaining ride?
I came close. Yeah. It was NCIS. I don't know.
So here's what I wanted to ask you about that. Now, maybe I'm getting the shows wrong because I confused the initial shows. But NCIS, that's the Mark Harmon show, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so you wrote this line for Mark Harmon and you talk about this in the book. And he basically asks you to come to set and he says, I'm having trouble with this line. And you say, all right, well, what's the trouble? And he explains it and you're like, I don't know. And then you say, can you just, let me just hear you say it. And
right.
He says it and you're like, it sounds fine to me. And then you ask, I guess the director of the show to confirm that it sounds fine. And they're like, yeah, it sounds fine.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it sounds like Mark essentially shrugs his shoulders. All right. And he goes off and he does it. But what struck me about that story is afterwards, you say that you really regret that moment.
Oh, I did. Because I think he was being very polite. And when he was saying, I don't know about this line, I think I sound weak, instead of saying, yes, you're that character. You've been playing him a long time. You know him very well. Let's change it. I dug my heels in. And I also give him huge credit because I've worked on shows where when an actor doesn't like a line, they go out and they tank it. Mm. And he didn't do that. He sold it and he did make it work. But I should have been more sensitive.
The collaboration in television writing in particular is so fraught. And it's both It can be incredibly supportive. It can be incredibly competitive. It can be incredible political. And that is true for all office environments. However, the difference with the TV writer's room is generally you're all literally sitting in the same room all day, yes, every day. And then
it's
you...
It's why, can I just say, please, the best advice I've ever got was to drink lots of water so you have an excuse to leave and pee.
I mean, that's excellent advice.
Yes.
And then you throw in the complicating wrinkle of gender and being either the only woman in a room or being vastly underrepresented in a room. And it seems like you have to learn to navigate treacherous waters very quickly and very well to survive. The broad question, and this is the bad question, but I'm looking for the better version of it, is how do you do that? I mean, how do you enter into that first moment when you look around and you've got your big break and you're walking into that writer's room and you look around and you go, oh shit, I'm the only woman here. How do you make that adjustment mentally in terms of how you prepare yourself to deal with the onslaught of the day?
Well, I did it by trying to ignore my gender entirely and tried to blend in. I grew up loving sports. I love science fiction. You know, I did memorize Monty Python. And so I really just tried to be one of the guys. And I felt that the sense of me not belonging came more from my colleagues than from myself.
Right. So do you feel like that strategy, I mean, it's a strategy because I'm sure it wasn't conscious for you, of just being one of the guys. Would you give your younger self that same advice now?
I would. But, you know, all advice is autobiographical, so right. I would give myself the same advice. I think, you know, I focused on the work. I always made it about what am I contributing, and I really put pressure on myself to contribute constantly. And you know, I'm the person who driving into work is already thinking up stories and jokes.
Was that instinct to overproduce?
Yes.
Was that driven by gender?
Well, someone once asked Sarah Silverman for her advice for any woman who wants to be a stand-up, and her response was, be undeniable.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is not fair. That women have
no.
to be undeniable, like just being solid.
Well, that's the thing.
Enough.
There is, I think, the frustration among women, people of color, whomever is sort of locked out of whatever group you're trying to get into. There is the acceptance and sometimes celebration of the mediocre because they fit a certain type.
Yeah,
there should be a place for the mediocre other.
Yes.
Right?
Well, I'd rather find the place for the brilliant other.
Of course, but you're a brilliant person.
No, but there's so many brilliant others who don't get in the door. And I really feel like affirmative action is misunderstood. It's not about letting unqualified others in. It's about not keeping qualified others out.
And I would say it's about making... The goal is to make the exceptional unexceptional, which I guess is what I mean in a sense,
yeah,
by celebrating the mediocre. It's like, yeah, you're here because you're here. Like
right.
When you look around a room, a writer's room of white dudes, you go, yeah, you're here because you're here.
Yeah.
You look around and you see the one Asian face or the one African-American in face and you zero in and you go, why are you here? It may be subconscious or unconscious, but you zero in and you go, that person must be exceptional in a certain sense. And
right.
So you expect exceptional work. And when they don't deliver,
that's right.
It's a strike against them or three strikes against yeah. them, as opposed to, you know, Joel, the dude sitting over there, not your Joel, but
yeah.
any Joel sitting over there. And you go, yeah, he's contributing. He's doing fine.
Yeah.
You know?
And, or maybe he's even not contributing, but he has a wife and kids.
Oh, interesting.
So we have to keep him around because it would be mean. And I think the perception that women aren't breadwinners, when they so often are, keeps them often from these high-paying jobs. Can I ask you about your...
Ask away.
I am such a fan of Another Period,
oh,
which is
thanks.
Obviously created by two brilliant women.
Yeah.
And I assume the writer's room is very, at least gender diverse.
So I did not write on that show until the third season. This last season, they asked me to come in and do a couple weeks. And I was like, yeah, I'd be honored. And you know what's funny? You asked that question. I'm like, what was the gender diversity?
But that's cool. Like, maybe you...
Ricky Lindholm and Natasha Leggero, two women, created the show. I remember there was at least one other woman in that room, of like a room of eight or nine. So that's already like at least half. But the people would come and go. I will say, racially, it was not diverse.
You know, Letterman's on the air for 33 years. He never hired a single writer of color.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
But wait, can we stay with another period? Yeah. Because you uttered what is my favorite line in sitcoms for a very long time. And it's a line that's so funny. Like, I can be walking down the street.
I'm going to take credit for this line no matter what it is.
I'm going to say, yeah, I wrote that. And smile.
What?
You don't want to guess?
I have no idea.
Okay, it was on the ship, the episode on the ship.
Yeah.
With Lady Dodo.
Yeah. I have no idea.
I'm trying to get you to say it.
I don't
Lady
even know.
Lady Dodo, get that ass in the air.
I did write that.
Yes. It's...
That was an improvised line.
That line makes me so happy.
I think I wrote that episode.
Take me, Peepers.
How would you like to be taken, madam?
Anyway, everywhere. Just tell me what to do.
Me tell you what to do, madam? I cannot.
I'm ordering you to order me.
Lady Dodo.
Yes.
Get that ass in the air.
I am more invested in Peepers and Lady Dodo's relationship than people are invested in, like, Claire and Jamie and Outlander.
That's so lovely.
And can I pitch? I just want to pitch quickly.
Please.
Commodore has a heart attack. Lady Dodo has to go buy a coffin. You know, big mahogany with velvet.
So he's dead.
Maybe, or he's close to. Uh-huh. She's planning ahead.
Yep, love it.
She brings Peepers with her.
Uh-huh.
They end up making love in the coffin. Which, by the way, the top falls.
Yep.
Or was it pushed?
Uh-huh.
They get buried alive. And
oh my God.
Peepers is both frightened but also really turned on because he might spend eternity with Lady Dodo.
That is so much better than anything we ever came up with. That's brilliant. I wanted to talk about Letterman and... It's such an interesting he's a fascinating guy, I think, in a lot of ways. And you worked
He's
briefly.
Fascinating, I think, because he is so successful and yet still so miserable.
Yeah.
Right?
Which I think is the key to it. Which I think is the key to kind of everything about that whole show.
Yeah.
Is his misery.
Now, this Two Lovers, now it's loosely based on a novel by Dostoevsky. Is that correct?
I don't know. I mean, I think
it might say that in the opening credits.
Oh, does it say that? Yeah. I haven't seen the movie.
Haven't seen the film yet, yeah. What a surprise.
And I tell this story about a woman, a friend of mine. I'm working on the show in 1990, and I have a friend who's a very smart book editor who has a crush on Dave. And, I mean, pre-beard Dave was very sexy. And she said to me, you know, could you get me a date with him? I know I could make him happy. Mm. So I coined this phrase, which was, a woman who thinks it would be fun to date David Letterman is a woman who knows nothing about show business.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because so much of it is driven by this self-loathing. And this misery that people carry with them to the point where I feel like people think it's a requirement for the job. And it's not.
No.
There's no reason that you have to hate yourself to be a creatively successful. In fact, I would argue it's the opposite, that it becomes a hindrance.
Yeah. And in the long term, and you have the added pressure of feeling like maybe I became successful because I was miserable, so I have to work to be miserable.
You worked on the show.
Not long.
Not long. You were, and you
It was my dream job.
Well, that's
too.
What I think is really important. You gave up, you said you took a 75% pay cut.
Yeah.
To go work on Letterman. You had submitted a packet 2 years earlier.
Yeah.
And then you get a call, I guess, out of the blue that says Dave wants to meet you. Oh, and it's important to note, you were only the second woman writer hired on that show after Meryl Marcoux, who
was Dave's girlfriend.
But also,
yeah,
I mean, she's on, you know, Rushmore, Mount Rushmore, in terms of like creating late night television.
No, so she came up like the dog videos with Bob, dog poetry. That's all Meryl.
Right.
And I always tease her because we're friends. That was the first dog video, and she invented the internet.
That's so funny.
Because the internet was made for people to show their dog videos.
So you're brought in. So what, can you describe the atmosphere of that show and that writer's room and why you left?
So I come to work. I love writing jokes. You know, that job was so, like, my favorite part of that job was you would get your top 10 list topic, and you had 45 minutes to an hour to just write all the jokes you could think of on that topic. And it was this institution where so many people who I admired had passed through, like Meryl, like George Meyer, like Chris Elliott. So I get the job, and I'm like, I still can feel the pride I felt walking to 30 Rock on that first day. And then, you know, you discover that there's actually not that much writing on those shows. You know, you have 14 writers, and there's only 10 jokes in the top 10, and maybe Dave does 3 monologue jokes, and there's one other comedy piece, but there's not a lot. So that was frustrating. And then on top of it, you know, we saw in 2009, Dave goes on air and admits that he had sex with women he worked with. So this is a surprise to no one who worked on the show. There were all these open secrets. And I want to be clear, too, it wasn't just Dave. There was a lot going on in that office. And for someone who's just there because she wants to work, it was really off-putting.
But it's clear, and you make it very clear, like Letterman himself, there was never anything like that with you. He never hit on you.
No, he was one of the nicest people to me there.
Yeah.
Actually, he made an effort. He'd stop by my office and say, you know, can I get you anything? Do you need some soup?
Just a kind of classic Letterman thing to say. Do you need some soup? But something about that atmosphere, despite the fact that he was really kind to you, made you shut off from him. Like you essentially, or literally, closed the door to him.
Right. So the head writer at the time was actually a really wonderful guy, Steve O'Donnell, super funny, super nice. But one day we're in the writer's room, and it was such a strange, I can't quite summarize it here, but Steve could only communicate with Dave on his car phone. This is pre-cell phones. So you had your office phone and your car phone. Uh-huh. So we would sit in the writer's room and wait for Dave to leave the office after the show, so Steve could call and pitch him ideas for the next day.
So weird.
So one morning, though, someone pitched an idea for a segment that we all agreed would be great to do that night. But Steve didn't want to go pitch it to Dave in his office, and then made a comment that, well, maybe when Dave stops by Nell's office, she could pitch it to him. Because like I said, I was on the corridor walking that he walked to his office. And I took that to mean that my immediate boss, the head writer, thought I was getting extra attention from his immediate boss.
Right.
So I took to closing my door, you know, right before I knew Dave, when he always came down at the same time, because I didn't want anyone to think I had gotten that job for any reason other than my talent.
And it's... But to me, that's such a kind of telling and upsetting example of the way gender politics can enter arenas in subtle and really destructive ways, because he never would have made that comment about a male writer. And your defensive reaction to it, which I think was probably correctly interpreted, shut out the guy who's running the show.
Yeah. The source of all the power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of cutting off an important relationship that you could be fostering
right.
because of somebody else's essentially gender bias against you.
Or the insecurity.
I get
it. The studies all show that companies with hierarchies have much higher instances of harassment and abuse. And it makes sense. If you have absolute power, you know, and it only flows in one direction, then people are going to take advantage of it. But I want to make it clear, too, that, you know, office romances happen. I'm not against those. It's just problematic when it's the boss.
Right.
Who has the power to hire and fire you.
There's a few sort of tough things you have to say about Letterman, and I think you kind of say them with love. I mean, I think I got the sense that there's a real affection there you have for him. But after the Kennedy Center Awards, when you hadn't seen each other in years,
yeah,
you kind of take him aside and you say, "Can I talk to you for a second?" And this is in the wake of this extortion plot in which he admitted on air that he had been having these relationships. And it sounds like you wanted to tell him the truth of why you left, about this difficult environment that existed there because of gender. And you try to talk to him about it, and he says, yeah, don't worry about that stuff.
Yeah, that stuff. And he was still on the air. So he makes this admission, and I wrote this article for Vanity Fair that got picked up a lot, and it not only discussed the sexual harassment and favoritism that I experienced on the show, but it then pivoted to the fact that at the time there were zero female writers in that writer's room and in Leno's writer's room. You know, you literally...
And in Conan's room.
Can't do worse. And in Conan's room. So Conan, though, quickly fixed that.
Yeah.
He really did. And he hired Laurie Kilmartin. And she's still on the staff, and she's amazing. She does stand up too. And they have a couple of other women on staff there. And I wanted to, I mean, that's the real reason I brought it up to Dave, was he was still on the air and they could hire more women. You know, I'm not someone who, like, if you hire one, then it's like, okay, you're done.
Right, we did it.
Yeah.
No, and in fact, you've got this great quote, and the quote is, when you're the only woman in the room, something's wrong.
Yeah, that's Alexandra Petri.
Right.
Yeah. So I was just curious if Dave had read this article, and his response, I don't worry about that stuff, just made it clear what... And this is why... I don't have a ton of hope. You know, and Dave's got a new Netflix show, 5 executive producers, all men. Hmm. And the reason, you know, it sounds like I'm beating up. I actually, for whatever reason, expect more from him.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason maybe is that he has become a kind of vocal advocate for women and people of color. And you've got this great line. You write, and you talk about how both he and Leno have become advocates for diversity in their retirement. And then you end the chapter with this, I think, really devastating line. And I'm quoting you now. The two former hosts now know something every woman learns early in her career. It sucks to be pushed aside by a less experienced man. And I was like, oh, shit.
That's how that feels.
You beat yourself up a little bit in this, because you talk about how you, as an advocate for women, didn't necessarily see the problem in terms of people of color when you were in charge of hiring and you were doing these things. When did you even become aware of this as an issue that you weren't seeing?
I think I was on the curve of intersectionality, and I wish I'd been ahead of it, but I wasn't. And I tried very hard in the book to say I'm not making excuses, because I think people tend to just get defensive, and I just wanted to say I made a mistake when I'm running Sabrina. You know, we had a female writer who was in a wheelchair. We did have one writer of Hispanic connections, but I should have had more voices in that room.
I think it's a difficult subject. First of all, I think it's hard for men to hear. I think it's hard for white men to hear. And I think it's hard for anybody with any authority, and that tends to be white men, to hear that they have come up short in their hiring practices or in the way they treat people.
Well, we want to believe it's a meritocracy.
Oh, yeah. Well,
especially, you know, if you're successful.
I mean, that might be the best joke you've said all day. Because it's just not. It's just not.
It's just not. And again, I want to stress that the reason to have the different voices is it will produce better comedy.
Well, that's exactly right. All right, Nell Scovell, as we wrap up, I end every episode of How to Be Amazing in the same manner, which is a section called The Amazing Five, in which I will ask you for a recommendation in each of five categories. So I will start with food. Any food from your life that you would recommend to others?
Otto's Pizza in Boston, mm-hmm. which has a mashed potato, bacon, and scallion pizza, and it is the greatest thing on the planet.
Okay, wait. Mashed potato, scallion, and what?
Bacon.
Oh, and bacon. And it's on just a traditional pizza
and
crust.
And cheese, but I don't know if it has tomato sauce. Yeah, but on...
Yeah, that was my next question.
Yeah, they use the mashed potato as kind of the...
The sauce?
The sauce.
Is it very buttery, mashed potatoes? Because that sounds a little dry. Potato sounds like a dry sauce to me.
There's some cheese in there, too.
All right.
Yeah.
Music.
Well, is it too dated to say no. Hamilton?
No.
Which I'm still listening to.
Did you start listening when it came out?
Yes.
And you're still listening?
I left for a little while, and then I came back.
Have you picked up the remixes?
I haven't.
Oh, my God.
I know, but then I'll be obsessed with two things.
No. You'll just move from one to the other, and then you may move back to the one.
Okay.
Have you seen the musical?
I did, and here's what a good mom I am. I took my two sons, and we had to get one partial obstructed view seat.
Oh.
And I sat in it. So I've seen 3/4 of Hamilton.
Did you see the New York version?
New York, yeah. with the original cast.
Lynn was my second guest.
Oh,
and
wow.
This was before Hamilton came out, and he was just working on it. And we were talking a little bit about it, and I made the really, really trenchant observation that this is either going to be really fantastic or one of the worst things I've done. Because he's like, no, it's a hip-hop opera about Alexander Hamilton. I'm like, that sounds terrible. So, yeah, I'm clearly an idiot. Books.
So this is really embarrassing because when I was writing my book, I sort of had to stay away from reading a lot of books. But I really recommend Carly Simon's memoir.
Wait, why is that embarrassing?
Well, because I want to be a reader, and I kind of got it. No, I'm. It's one of the things I'm looking forward to is kind of getting back into that stack. But Carly Simon's memoir, if you've ever wondered what it's like to have sex with Warren Beatty, read this memoir. She really kind of describes it. It's nice.
But my question is, when you say it's nice, do you mean the experience of having sex with Warren Beatty is nice, or the writing about it is nice, or both?
Oh, everything.
Oh, good.
Everything.
Oh,
I felt like I was in bed with him.
Current Warren Beatty or 40 year ago Warren Beatty? Either one. It would probably both be fine.
Yeah. Are you going to say movie next? And
no.
No.
I'm going to say film or television. But you were close.
Well, I'm going to say another period. If you haven't seen the show, I get the little ping. I buy it on iTunes and get the ping that there's a new episode of another period, and it makes me happy.
I would be flattered, except I take no credit for the show. So I don't take ownership of that. I'm like, that's really nice because I think it's really funny too.
Yeah.
All right, another period on Comedy Central, which I will also recommend. Just as a fan of it, I think it's really funny.
Got to get it.
And then finally... Miscellaneous, anything from your life that you love that you would recommend to others?
Albert Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus.
Hmm.
It's a short essay. It's kind of got everything in there.
You're the first to recommend Camus, by the way. You're the first. It's the first existentialist recommendation. So I definitely appreciate that.
But in these times, I think it actually would resonate for many people.
And with that, I want to...
Come on, Lady Dodo. Just let me hear it. Just let me hear it.
Lady Dodo! Get that ass in the air.
Thank you.
And with that, I want to thank Nell Scovell, first of all, for the book, second of all, for all your work, and third, and just as importantly, or maybe more importantly, for helping so many people along the way. Thank you for everything, and thank you for being amazing.
Oh, this is a pleasure. Thank you.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, please write us a nice review on iTunes. Say how handsome I sound. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio, New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Jason Saldanha with music composed by Chad Crouch. I am, as always, Michael Ian Black.